We want a smash, crash, blast, mass, blast the system. We want to get it hype, get it live, get with the mission. We want the crowd loud, this pumping rhythm is hitting. We want to make it clear, we ain't scared. This is the vision we want.
Welcome to the Project Censor Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Peter Phillips in studio with co-host and fellow sociologist Michael Socop. Mickey Huff will return next week. In today's show, we interview political scientist and author Michael Parenti on the American empire and the escalating dangers of global war. During the second segment of the show, we'll talk to Sonoma State University student journalist Noah Traynor about his recent trip to Standing Rock and get a quick update from Paulette Moore, who's in North Dakota. We end the show with a report from Ann Garrison on the continuing lies of disinformation regarding Rwanda. We hope you stay tuned. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Peter Phillips with fellow sociologist Michael Socop today, filling in for Mickey Huff, who will be back next week. In today's show, we're going to interview political scientist and author Michael Parenti on the American empire and the escalating dangers of war. We'll have updates on Standing Rock, and we'll hear from Ann Garrison on issues with Rwanda, so stay tuned. Michael, will you introduce Michael Parenti for us?
Sure, Peter. Michael Parenti was born and raised in an Italian-American working-class family in New York City. After high school, he worked for a number of years, then returned to school, eventually earning a BA from City College of New York, an MA from Brown University, and a PhD in political science from Yale University. His 24 published books include The Face of Imperialism, 2011, God and His Demons, 2010, The Assassination of Julius Caesar, 2003, and Democracy for the Few, 9th edition, 2010. And Michael, you've talked a lot about the American empire, and it's, of course, it's relevant in today's context more than ever. What exactly do you mean by the American empire?
What the United States does pretty much is take control of vast areas around the world, and there's a pattern as to how they do it and why they do it. Let me begin with 9/11, which I'm not going to say much about at all. But I just want to point out that the media immediately announced that there was a Saudi group of perpetrators. Bush saw this. George W. Bush was president. And to act against the Saudi perpetrators, he called for war against Iraq. Now, how do you figure that out? And then he invaded Afghanistan. And then after invading Afghanistan and denouncing Iraq, that's just an opener. Then there were all sorts of attacks that came along. Bush and his fellow think tankers, or they all were in one think tank, Wolfowitz, Cheney, the others, had been talking the summer before 9/11. The summer before, they had been talking about the necessity to really wipe out Iraq, to wipe out Saddam Hussein. Now, this is interesting because Saddam Hussein was their heroes for years, for any number of years. He was working with the CIA to exterminate perpetrators of democracy in Iraq, and he killed quite a few of them, and he took over. But here's what Saddam Hussein did when he took over. He started committing all sorts of sins that gets the Pentagon and the CIA and the DIA and the White House very annoyed and very outraged. Saddam Hussein started pushing education programs for Iraqis. He started keeping and spending the oil for the needs and the development of his own society. He started taking care of his own markets and such. Iraq had the highest standard of living in the Middle East. This was when Saddam Hussein, when all this was going on. And that's the point I want to make. Saddam Hussein had been Washington's poster boy. He used to come to the U.S. and he was seen as a great guy. Because what did he do? He smashed social democratic groups in Iraq and put in his own autocracy. But then he absolutely surprised the American leaders by turning out to be doing many of the same things that the people who he was killing. He just wanted it all under his control. He took that oil and he was spending it on his own population. In other words, any leader around the world, or any movement, anybody who uses the land in his country, in his own country, uses the land, the labor, the natural resources, and the markets for self-development, that person begins to be seen as an evil person, a Hugo Chavez, a Noriega, a Milosevic, you know, a whole bunch of them, as you know, and they
Gaddafi.
Are... What?
Gaddafi,
Assad.
Yes.
Assad was another one. When Assad of Syria, when there were literally tens of thousands of refugees coming down from Iraq into Syria, Assad opened up, gave them full benefits, you know? It wasn't just a tent you can sit in. So these were the people who they go after. Hugo Chavez. Hugo Chavez starts taking profits from the oil in Venezuela and using it for food programs, for housing, for education, this and that. And we start hearing all sorts of things about him in the media. And many of these things are contrived, too. How many of us, just about 2 weeks ago, the High Tribunal in The Hague just came out with a decision that Slobodan Milosevic was not guilty of genocide and was not guilty of atrocities committed after the war.
And that got zero coverage in the corporate media of the United States.
It's an amazing thing.
As if we forgot Milosevic. He's still demonized.
It's an amazing thing. I think CNN said one line on it or something. But it's an amazing thing that all the varied media, supposedly, we have in this country, nobody touched it. Nobody made a truthful comment about it. This is what the empire is about. The American people pay the bills, and the bill is a stupendous one. It's trillions of dollars for global militarism all around the world. And that empire feeds off the republic. To go back to Eisenhower's famous talk, every dollar you spend on tanks and guns and bombs is one less dollar for schools, for food, for needs and housing and the like.
It's really interesting that that connection seems to have been completely lost on the population for good reasons.
The connection of what? Between empire and republic.
Spending on military abroad in defense of empire and the impoverishment of the domestic front.
Right. Yes. Yes.
Michael, how far along is the American empire? I mean, this is certainly all post-World War II, the building of bases around the world, maybe close to 1,000 bases now, partnering with NATO, going through the Cold War with the goal of, you know, undermining the Soviet Union and their ultimate breakup. But now it continues. It continues in some very big ways. I mean, what is the goal here for the American empire? Is it total world domination?
It's total world domination, and it's a world of a lot of indeterminacies, nervousness changes. So if things are not fixed and controlled well enough, they control and they fix and they get into it, but not enough. It's never enough. Kosovo now, they have this huge base, like one they...
Camp Bondsteel.
Yeah, they dream of these kind of things. If they can build 10 or 15 more of those things in various key spots, they'd be even happier, you know. The other thing that I've always noticed is rather distressing is that there's a mechanism used by the U.S. propaganda, imperialist propaganda, empire builders, and that is to produce a demonization of foreign leaders. Any leader who's using the land, the labor, the resources, the markets, and whatever else in ways that are helping his country, that guy will be targeted. As I just said, as Saddam Hussein was suddenly targeted, went from top guy, one of America's good friends, to one of America's evil guys, and we got to knock him off. And that is, you demonize these leaders. You just say, they hate us, they don't like us, they're hostile to us. And it's just amazing how the American public will accept that view. You tell them that somebody is hostile to us and this and that, they immediately pick it up and they support and they trust their own leaders to go in and get these guys, you know. And who's demonized is the kind of leader who shows any kind of reform or independence and I named a number of them already.
So certainly the demonization of Putin has been ongoing. He's blamed for the situation in Ukraine. He's certainly being blamed for the situation in Syria.
Yes,
we're talking no-fly zones there, which could end up with American planes versus Russia planes over the in the sky shooting each other, literally, which is, could be a spark for global war. How deliberate is this?
Well, you know, they always overlook the fact that Putin actually asked to join NATO. In other words, he wanted to take the line of hostility back and away. It would be the last line, the last border. It was Ukraine and Poland, and that's that. So I think that's where it comes in. And you had somebody like, and during those last 8 years, you had somebody like Barack Obama. He was busy. He's very busy in those 8 years, kissing GOP butts for 8 years, talking about how we got to reach across the aisle and hug each other and this and that. And Obama had a Nobel Peace Prize. It was given to him. And meanwhile, you know, there was one point where he was waging war, Michael and Peter, he was waging war against five countries: Iraq, Libya, Yemen, Syria, Afghanistan. At the same time, more or less, there was some level of battle going on, but always painting it so that it looks like the U.S. is being threatened or attacked because we're so happy, we're so prosperous, they're jealous about us, and they want to come in and take it away from us.
Michael, in terms of the politics and psychology of so-called terrorism, and given that Barack Obama was given a fairly sizable mandate in both of his electoral victories, how do you understand the machinations of empire as filtered through a leader like Obama, who, of course, at least on the surface, wanted to be responsive to the electorate that got him where he is, but the other hand, facing many internal and structural pressures to perform in other ways?
Well, I think I said he continues along the same path. They all do it. Some are cruder and more persistent than others, but they're all pushing and pushing and pushing and expanding that empire. And Obama is really, unfortunately, no different whatsoever. And I think that's the way it's going to keep going.
I guess what I'm asking is, maybe this is an issue on the level of personality or individual psychology, but, you know, to what extent do you think a leader of an empire such as Barack Obama, who got to that position through sizable electoral victories, is there something that happens in a mindset of a person like that where they're immediately subject to the pressures of empire as filtered through other decision makers or corporations or, you know, external structural pressures on him to perform in a certain way?
Well, I think he's had those various pressures to perform in a certain way ever since he was at Harvard trying out for the review. I mean, there's obviously certain boundaries where, you know, he won't go, he doesn't go. He came out when there was a strike at Harvard and spoke for the students good-naturedly and all that, but it was sort of a pop or something. So I don't see him as having ever done anything. What I just see when he was president was his obsession with being loved by the Republicans, and the more he did this, the more they kicked him. In 8 years, he never threw a punch himself. I mean, really, figuratively speaking. The one time I would say he departed was when he refused to start a war with Iran. And that was very good. You know, that would have meant another terrible destruction and terrible numbers of killed and many, many refugees and this. And it would have been all the horrors that Iraq has become. So he did hold back on that one. But other than that, as I said, I gave you his scorecard with Iraq, Libya, Yemen, Syria, and Afghanistan. And then there's Ukraine, too, in a way. He's been, you know, feeding it to the boys in Kiev. So I don't see him as a man of peace. I see him as a big smoothie.
In many ways, Michael, we could think that that's almost expected of any president today. I mean, the last president to really challenge the military-industrial establishment was John F. Kennedy, and we know what happened to him. Certainly, the empire costs a great deal of money, and we're seeing now a greater involvement with NATO worldwide. I mean, NATO's helping out in Iraq. They were all over Libya. They're part of occupying the Balkans. do you see NATO as being a global role in protecting not only U.S. empire, but global capitalism, private
yes.
corporations?
That's exactly what it does. And it has the virtue, I put quote marks around virtue, it has the virtue of not having to get all locked up in the Security Council and what happens at the U.N. So you can have this organized group of political forces.
Well, it's like the Atlantic Council, which gives advice to NATO.
Right.
And the Bilderberger Group and the Trilateral
right.
Commission.
And the Trilaterals.
They're all laying out agendas for the G7 and the G20 and their intelligence agencies to implement worldwide. And that, of course, is bringing us nearer and nearer to continued confrontations with both Russia and China. And the threat, the obvious threat of confrontations escalating to a point of exchange of nuclear weapons.
It's hard to say what would happen. Messing around with Russia and China is a little different than Iraq, Iran, and all that. You know, they're the big boys with the big toys. You know, the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which the U.S., it's getting outplayed by the Chinese starting an international trading. They've got 32 members, and the TPP has only about 12, I think. So the Chinese had that way of moving deliberately and not acting terribly impressed or worried by America's or U.S.'s power. You know, when the U.S. came in and the China-South Sea dispute that went on and said, we'll preside over it, and the Chinese said, who the hell wants you for a mediator? Nobody invited you here. You don't even live in this area. That point's always been made. What if the Russians or the Chinese offered to go in and mediate the people crossing the border to get work, or illegal immigrants and such? That wouldn't be allowed. It would be insulting, it would seem to be.
If not considered a threat to American empire.
We've got about five more minutes, Michael. In your book, The Assassination of Julius Caesar, you describe a populist leader killed by the ruling elites in Rome. Do you think a populist leader or a Bernie Sanders-like leader in the U.S. that really became supported by, you know, a large majority of the people could survive, be tolerated by the elites?
Well, I think there are all sorts of leaders who are very nervous about how far they go in a critical direction, and they wonder if one can just come out and say this, that, and the other thing. So I would say, yes, it was on my mind when I heard Bernie, in fact, giving his talks. He really did not touch the empire, really. He discussed income accumulation and the super rich versus the working poor at home, the domestic. And he didn't talk about the enormous trillions of dollars that have been spent on our empire, our bases and our interventions. I mean, their interventions.
So, Michael Parenti, again, what is it about someone like a Bernie Sanders, who probably on some level is considered a threat to empire, but, I mean, does someone like that self-censor out of fear, or are they too much caught up in the political game of getting elected?
At a certain point, you probably do find yourself avoiding certain issues and emphasizing other issues and the like. Bernie, for instance, never raised the question to Hillary about her role as Secretary of State, and I don't recall that he did. Bernie's a close personal friend of mine. I've known him for 30 years, 40 years, so I was really thrilled and happy to see him move forward in that way and to bring that kind of backing. All of a sudden, we just dream of something like that. And who knows, with an honest count and all that, he could have maybe won the nomination. But I don't recall him really engaging the issue of empire, really. People who engage the issue of empire, they make criticism, and the criticisms are always, oh, we're being overweening, or oh, we're trying to save too much of the world or all at once. No, those aren't the problem. That's not the problem. The problem is the interests that are being served and the interests that are being hurt.
Michael Parenti, thank you very much for being with us today. I've used your book, Democracy for the Few, in my classes, and certainly recognize your long historical involvement in these issues of empire and power. So thank you very much for joining us today, and we're going to now take a short musical break.
Now you masters of war, you that build all of the guns, you that build the dead planes, you that build the big bombs, you that hide behind walls, you that hide behind desks. Just want you to know that I see through your mask. You that never done nothing but build to destroy. You play with my world.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Peter Phillips. My co-host today is Michael Socott. We're going next to a student from Sonoma State University. His name is Noah Traynor. He's a communication studies major, and he's a reporter for the Sonoma State Star newspaper. He recently drove to Standing Rock and wrote a front-page story in the newspaper about the water protectors and what's happening up there. Noah, are you with us?
I am with you. Hi, how's it going?
Great. I really liked your article. It's entitled SSU Student's Journey to Standing Rock. And it sounds like you had quite an experience up there. What motivated you to drive, 30 hours to get there and spend a few days?
Yeah, it turned out to be about a 30-hour drive. What motivated me, I'm just going to come straight out and say it, was I'm writing for a college paper, and college issues were a little bit too minuscule for me. I needed something bigger. I needed something that felt like it mattered more than the school volleyball games. So I decided to pack up, brought a couple buddies with me for the drive, and made my way out to Standing Rock.
And while you were there, you were registered as a journalist.
Correct.
And attended some of the confrontations with the police. Tell us about that.
First of all, let me say I came back with a bit of PTSD. It was all a very traumatic event for me, for everybody there to experience firsthand. I didn't know what I was getting myself into. I had no clue the force that was being used out there. I went out there to see it firsthand. I had heard both sides of accounts. I had heard accounts from the water protectors. I had heard accounts from the Morton County Sheriff's Department. And I wanted to use my own two eyes to just really get out there and form my own opinion and form my own stance on what was going on. And the day, I believe it was a Saturday, the day of a little over 150 people were arrested. And it was really something to see people in prayer, people joined in hands, people proclaiming their love for police officers and proclaiming their love for this country, but also people standing up for what they believe in, what they believe is right, and standing up for their sacred grounds and for their own people. It was riveting to see the police treat people who could form together and stand in peace and stand in prayer, and then to watch these militarized police take force and take initiative and deliver the force that they felt was right. It was very scary to see how they can just deem any situation a riot, or they can deem any situation uncontrollable, or that they need to use excessive force to handle it. Lost for words, talking about these kind of things in the last week or so has brought up so many tears and so much anxiety. At times, people can hear it in my voice. You can hear it in anybody's voice who's been out there. It's really something to go through, to experience, to witness police funded by our own governments taking control of a situation, taking control of protesters, taking control of people, and throwing them in the jail, throwing any kind of charges they want on them. I think scary would be the ultimate way to wrap it up.
Noah, this is Michael Sukoff. What you're expressing now comes through the printed words, but even more so live on the air. I'm wondering, at the protest site, did you witness any of the protesters or water protectors having interaction with the police?
From the side that I was standing on, which was the side of the water protectors, I was on that side of the line. All I ever heard, all I ever saw, what I witnessed, what I have video recordings of, is water protectors proclaiming their love for police officers and talking to them and telling them that we understand this is your job. We understand this is what you're getting paid to do, but we're here for you as well. We're not only here for ourselves, but we're here for you, and we're here for your children, and we're here for the future of this world. And all they were met with was quiet, you're going to be arrested, step back, and violence. I mean, of course, the police officers aren't there to negotiate with water protectors, and these specific water protectors aren't there to negotiate with the officers. It is a protest protection, but all the encounters, everything that was said towards the officers was just met with aggression and violence from the officers. There was no "I love you" back. It was "I love you," and then you got body slammed.
In another respect, I was reading some blogosphere accounts purportedly from local ranchers and people who live in the area. Of course, you know, we don't know authentically who these people were, but they were claiming that their hay was started on fire. And of course, they're also throwing around words like violence and rooters and rioters. Did you have any sense from talking to anybody on location there about the character or even existence of any, you know, confrontations between local residents and protesters or alleged protesters?
Let me answer that first by saying that I have footage of local ranchers who were from out there who went out on the day of our protest and who were told to get on the ground and arrested. They were white ranchers out there who owned land property. I'm not sure exactly what land property, but they were out there and they were marching in solidarity with these protesters. This is something that might come off as almost like a sounding conspiracy-esque, but there are people there from paid security who have come to the camp and are posing as water protectors. And these people are from Knightsbridge Security. They are paid to come into camp to stir up problems. And then when protests come and we're out there on the front lines and the water protectors are in prayer, rush the front lines and push people into police officers, causing altercations between peaceful protesters and police who, I'm assuming, in all right, are trying their best to not be violent. I don't want to demonize the police. I am assuming that they are trying their best to stay away from violence, but there are paid people there.
Agent provocateurs, yeah.
In these protests.
Right. We're going to have to let you go, Noah, but thank you so much for your on-the-scene report.
You can see Noah's report by going to Sonoma State University, The Star. I encourage people to take a look at that. I enjoyed reading your article, certainly more than I see at the college newspaper very often. And I really wanted to have you on the air and acknowledge your work. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
My people been fighting before I was born. I light up this stage right before I record. The government broke all the treaties before. This time around, we won't take it no more. Wanna find us? We'll be standing. They tried to kill us off, it'll never happen this time. Wanna find us, we'll be standing with our fists tied. They tried to kill us off, it'll never happen this time. Let me paint a picture that can wash away the ignorance. Play it through the speakers just to make sure that they listen. It. We treat it like prisoners in this country that we living in. Everything is fine till the soil that we swimming in. Companies are acting like this fuel is unlimited. Ignoring repercussions just cause they don't have to live with it. Let me come and dig a hole up in your front yard.
You know, we're faced with several hundred people choosing to live and block, called the Black Snake, the pipeline that will be carrying fracked crude oil crossing the Missouri River and endangering. There's hundreds of breaks every year in pipelines around the world and the country and endangering us. So that is an ongoing issue there. What we saw recently, too, is how deeply embedded the pipeline project is in terms of banks in the world. I mean, there's a website called littlesis.org, and it has documented that the primary banks, Wells Fargo, Bank of America, Barclays, all have money invested in this $3.5 billion project. So the core of capitalism is backing this, which certainly represents why not only private companies, private security companies like G4S are up there protecting this capital, but then the entire apparatus of the police state is involved there as well. So it's an ongoing issue.
It's very interesting, and given we just had Michael Brente on talking about empire, and I'm thinking about President Obama's somewhat mutive, supportive response with reference to the rights of Native Americans and so forth. It seems like he's trying to politically place himself so as to somewhat placate the protesters, while at the same time leaving his other options open. So to me, that's another example of what Michael Parenti was talking about, how it filters down on a social, psychological level to the ways in which our political leaders, or misleaders in certain cases, will try and frame an issue.
So I'm looking at Sarah Van Gilder's report, the report from Standing Rock, Fierce Resistance, The Black Snake Approaches the River. The camp is a hive of activity, people splitting firewood, erecting a giant dome, patrolling on horseback, cooking food over the fire and that. So a good friend of mine from Sonoma County was up there helping to design a winter water system. So we think that people are there to stay. They've gotten the attention of folks all over the world, and certainly for a young 20-something college student to decide to drive all the way up there to get the story is an amazing piece as well. Joining us on the air now is Paulette Moore. She's a Native American woman, a Mohawk filmmaker. Paulette, are you with us?
Hello.
Good to hear you. Michael Sukoff is my co-host today, and we want to get an update on what's been going on up there.
What we witnessed was a water action where a bridge was built to the last bit of buffer between where DAPL is building and the river, and the Missouri River. And it's Army Corps land. They had permission to be there. They stayed up. Some water protectors stayed up all night and built a floating bridge, put an enormous amount of energy in that. And to build this, you know, kind of ramshackle bridge that floats across the water so people could go over and do ceremony. In the morning, we saw the police. We saw 40 Humvees starting to line up on 1806, which is north of the camp. And this location called Turtle Island, again, it's Army Corps land. We saw the police come up and over in front of the bridge that the water protectors were creating. And they came down, about 200 or 300 water protectors gathered. And a group of law enforcement came in a boat and took a grappling hook and pulled that bridge away. And so water protectors started swimming across to the other side. It wasn't very wide, but the water was very cold, very dangerous. They gathered in a line on the other side, and they were maced and shot with rubber bullets. I saw one young girl that couldn't have been more than 90 pounds that was pulled back over, you know, very cold and having an asthma attack from the mace that was put in her face. People were maced twice. And I think what your last guest was talking about are provocateurs who have been here who are pushing the protectors into the police line. And I would say that I've heard that and had that confirmed by a number of different sources, that there are provocateurs.
Paulette, this is Michael Sukoff. I'm trying to wrap my mind around what you're saying in the context of the decision that was jointly announced by the Army Corps of Engineers and two other federal government agencies, which I thought stipulated something to the effect that there was kind of a freeze on activity. So how do you square those two things?
Are you talking about the one that came out in September, the three agencies?
Yeah.
So in September, the statement that came out is that the three agencies, they requested voluntarily that DAPL shut down their operations close to the river. So it was a voluntary, it was an ask. It was not a demand.
And they refused.
They refused. They kept going, in fact, quite quickly. The only thing that's left is a permit to go under the Missouri River. That will be issued by the Army Corps. They're right next to the river now. There was a no-fly zone for a number of days, so the drones that come out of Standing Rock Camp could not see what progress was made. So the violent action that you probably heard about with the ceremony and like 150 people being arrested were the water protectors trying to stop them from that last jump across Route 1806, and then it's like 2 days to the river, 2 days of building to the river. So they haven't been able to see what the progress was after that jump was made, so they continued in a run toward the river as like a fait accompli, like, oh, hey, you just got to give us the permit. That's going on. The drones went up 2 days ago, and there's amazing footage. They have built it so fast, they've actually built a drill pad that is within about a quarter mile of the river.
Thank you, Paulette. We're out of time right now. Paulette is there, and she agreed to step in because Sarah Van Gilder, who's there with Yes Magazine, also asked her to. We're going to take a short musical break.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth.
just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, big-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short head, yellow belly, son of tricky dick. He's gonna mother of a top, so me was just a pocket full of hope. Money for dough, money for rope.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Peter Phillips in studio here with Michael Sukoff. And our next guest is Anne Garrison. She's an independent journalist, KPFA news broadcaster, and she specializes in issues regarding the African Great Lakes area. You were recently at an event for Rwanda in San Francisco. Anne, could you tell us about what happened there?
Yes, I was escorted, so to speak, out by the police, the San Francisco police. They were holding this event called Rwanda Day at the Marriott Marquis in San Francisco. And this is one of these events that only the government of Rwanda holds in metropolises throughout the West once a year. Usually there is some kind of a demonstration. Usually Rwandan and Congolese people get together to protest. These have been going on since 2011, but there isn't a large Rwandan community here, and Friends of the Congo told me that their people were so focused on the violence having to do with the upcoming election, or the election rather that's been postponed in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, that it was hard to get their attention. So there were police there, and the hotel was prepared for a demonstration, but all they got was myself and another San Francisco Bayview journalist, Jeremy Miller, who came through the lines, took our seats in the audience, and seemed to be home free until someone came up and asked us to follow him, at which point we were escorted out, and the police came to help.
So you were banned from attending this ceremony as a journalist because you were recognized as not in support of the Rwandan government, perhaps. Were you planning to demonstrate or do anything? Were you just there? You're going to write a story, which you did.
Yeah, that's all I was going to do. I was not going to disrupt their event. It was their event. But they recognized me. They've drawn cartoons of me slobbering all over the KPFA microphone in various journals that they put out criticizing, quote-unquote, genocide deniers, which is what I'm supposed to be.
That terminology, of course, genocide denier is very close to Holocaust denier, which is the origins of attacking and in many countries in Europe against the law. But in your case, this is about Rwanda and the massacres that happened during a civil war there several years back. And you have a clear understanding that it isn't as much a genocide attack as has been purported, and that Paul Kagame, the president there now, is very much in the circle of the American State Department. Is that correct?
Very much, very much. And thinking forward to this, I watched Democracy Now!'s program on the Rwandan genocide anniversary, the 20-year anniversary in 2014. And I saw that they reported most of the standard story that is in the Wikipedia, that is fiercely defended in the Wikipedia, and that is constitutionally codified and legally enforced in Rwanda. And that leaves out the context, which is that there was a four-year war from 1990 to 1994, and the massacres that were depicted in the movie Hotel Rwanda were the last 100 days.
So this was an ongoing war that had had massive civilian casualties. Kagame was really part of an invading army that had occupied half of Rwanda.
Exactly.
And then all of a sudden, the refugees on the other side, there was massive killings across the board. And according to Ed Herman, there were just as many Hutus killed as there were Tutsis.
Yeah, and that's actually particularly Alan Stamm and Christian Davenport, who did 10 years of research in Rwanda and are now persona non grata, concluded that there weren't enough Tutsis in Rwanda for 500,000 or 800,000 to be killed. If that were true, they would have all been killed. plus a few hundred thousand more.
So who's Reverend Rick Warren?
Reverend Rick Warren, you may remember him. There was an uproar when he gave the invocation for Obama's inauguration the first time in 2008. And he was notorious for promoting Proposition 8, which banned gay marriage in California. I think that was also 2008. He's also very active in Africa, and particularly Rwanda, where he keeps expanding his evangelical empire. And one thing about Rick Warren attending this event was that to have brought Rick Warren up here from Saddleback Church in Southern California means they were not able to get any local luminaries. I was wondering whether the mayor or some supervisors or anyone like that would turn out to join this. No one did. The only press I know of to have shown up were from the Bay Area Reporter, which is a gay publication, and they were there to ask Rick Warren what he was doing in Rwanda, whether he was promoting homophobia and so forth. And he said he had softened his position on that, which he's sort of had to do.
So, Anne, in the context of what Peter was referring to before in terms of the broader interest of the U.S. and the State Department with regard to this issue, do you see Rick Warren as kind of a loose cannon who was just called in by the Rwandans' establishment at the last minute, or were there other things going on behind the scenes that we may not know too much about?
Well, he actually recently had an argument with the head of whichever Christian church is dominant, I think the Anglican. But he showed up at this anyway, so that must have been healed. He came out with like four reasons that people like myself, he said, you know, you can't trust journalists about Rwanda. There are only a few of them, but they're very vocal. And then he listed four reasons why people criticize Rwanda, or, you know, they're jealous, they resent Rwanda's, et cetera, et cetera. They resent Rwanda's success. And in order to expand his evangelical empire, he is willing to ignore all of the evidence and all of the criticism of Paul Kagame, including Philip Renschens. This is a Belgian scholar who says that he thinks Kagame is the greatest living war criminal in office today.
Certainly, he's a person who has used his troops to cross the border into Congo and supposedly chasing resistors, and works closely with corporations that are interested in the material wealth in the region, and he was trained by the U.S. military. So you put all that together, and then the State Department totally supported him. And what kind of closeness does he have with the Clinton family?
Oh, very close. I have a quote here that I'd like to read from Boniface Musavuli, who is the author of Congolese Genocide from Leopold II to Kagame. I asked him why was he so alarmed by the prospect of the Clintons' return to the White House, and this is what he said. We must compare the return of the Clintons to the White House for the Congolese to the possibility of George Bush returning to the White House for Iraqis. The lies of the Congolese will become a disaster. If Hillary Clinton is honest, she should, for example, announce the creation of an international criminal tribunal for the Congo. Such an announcement would allow the Congolese people not to live in fear of new wars, massacres, looting, and rape if the Clintons return to the White House. Well, no, there's not going to be any such criminal tribunal, and he knows this. That was his way of explaining something. I want to make sure, I know we don't have much time, something I want to make sure to get in here is that the Clinton Foundation received $100 million from the London Group, which is one of their most rapacious corporations. It's a Canadian corporation, Canadian conglomerate. It's one of the most rapacious corporations in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Makes deals with warlords, puts together its own militias, etc.
We're speaking with Anne Garrison, who is an independent journalist, a KPFA news broadcaster, and specializes on issues on African Great Lakes region. We're talking about Rwanda. Anne Garrison, let's go back to 1990 and what was going on in Rwanda, and give us a brief history of what happened then.
In 1990, a detachment of the Ugandan army invaded Rwanda. They were largely refugees from the Hutu Revolution of 1959 to 1961.
And these were led by Kagame, right?
These were led by Kagame, yeah. The leader was actually assassinated within a day, and then Kagame took over. But George Bush was president at the time. Bill Clinton became president in 1992. And a friend of mine who was part of the Rwandan army at the time trying to resist this invasion said at the time that Bill Clinton became president, there was a big increase in the support for the invaders. In 1994, a peace agreement had been arranged such that there would be an election. An election would be coming up, and there was no doubt that a member of the Hutu majority would be elected. So Paul Kagame saw that he could not win an election. Then the Hutu president of Rwanda and the Hutu president of Burundi were assassinated. And I don't know anyone familiar with this story who doesn't agree that Paul Kagame ordered the assassination. The French court has just reopened its investigation of that, which they took up because a number of French citizens died when the plane of the two presidents was shot out of the sky. That triggered panic, and the massacres began, and they included most certainly massacres of Tutsi. But it's coming out now. Judy Rivera, who's writing a book about the crimes of the Rwandan Patriotic Front, has recently offered testimony about Tutsis killing Hutus.
Well, certainly the books I've read about this history has Paul Kagame as the basically the U.S.'s man in the region. He was trained here in the United States at the military academy. And he became very friendly with Bill Clinton. And he was recognized by the U.S. and continues to this day to be supported by U.S. State Department and policy. So talk a little bit about that relationship.
Even after 20 years of U.N. reports about the Rwandan army's crimes in Rwanda and in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and about the looting of billions of dollars worth of resources from the Eastern Democratic Republic of the Congo, Bill Clinton gave Paul Kagame his Global Citizen Award. This is an award he gives out at the Clinton Global Initiative every year, and called him one of the greatest leaders of our time. Several months later, Reverend Rick Warren, who was in San Francisco for this recent event, gave Paul Kagame his International Peace Award. This same award Reverend Rick Warren gave to George Bush and, more recently, Tony Blair.
Well, that's a nice combination of folks.
To receive a peace award, yeah.
So to make a long story short, you're really talking about Paul Kagame, who's been in power since the mid-90s in Rwanda.
Since 1994.
And his armies now invade the Congo with regularity in support of international group, mineral mining and that have given heavily to the Clinton Foundation.
Yeah, the London Group in particular. Every resource required to manufacture modern life exists in the Eastern Congo. And one aspect of that that rarely gets much attention is that resources absolutely necessary to the Pentagon, to military manufacture, exist there as well.
And I'm sure this question may answer itself, but in the recent presidential election season, have any issues about the relationship of the U.S. and the U.S. government and corporations to interest in Africa in this area been thematized at all?
The one question that every president since 1994 has been asked is, would you have intervened in Rwanda? And this year, that is the one question about Africa south of the Sahara that is asked. This year, Hillary Clinton claimed that she urged her husband, Bill Clinton, to intervene in Rwanda at the time. And then there were some silly arguments in the Daily Kos about whether or not that was true. Bernie Sanders was asked the same question, and he said, yes, he would, we should, but Europeans should pay for more of such humanitarian interventions.
I wonder about that. I mean, is there any such thing as a humanitarian war? I mean, if you go in and start bombing people and then you increase the militarization, they have justified that in Darfur and they're saying we should have done that in Rwanda, which were serious civil wars, both of which the United States had vested interests, particularly in challenging China's involvement in the region and oil issues. So is that question even justified today? I mean, it's been assumed that the massacres happened because we didn't intervene. But give us your thoughts on that, Ann.
Well, first of all, the United States was waiting on the sideline for their guy, Paul Kagame, to seize power. Someone sent me a note, a Rwandan friend of mine who was the Rwandan ambassador in Uganda at the time. And he said, quote, "I was in Kampala in 1994. I saw personally U.S. Marines stationed at the Sheraton Hotel in Kampala, Uganda, waiting for the RPF takeover in order to enter Rwanda. Had they entered earlier and stopped the civil strife, the situation would have been different." After the violence was over and Kagame had seized power, the U.S. went in and built a military base, which they said they were building to help provide relief. 2 years later, and then again 4 years later, Uganda and Rwanda invaded the Democratic Republic of the Congo and ultimately left millions of people dead. So this was not much of a relief operation. As to whether or not there could be a humanitarian war, I think certainly not waged by the U.S. You have to think about what Ajamu Baraka said about this recently, the Green Party's vice presidential candidate. You have to ask yourself, when was the last time the U.S. intervened on behalf of the people? And the answer is never.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's really an important thing, Michael.
Just to follow up on that point, I mean, it sounds like at the very least, the U.S. government allowed the situation to deteriorate in that area and then took advantage of it for their own interests. So it was never a question of humanitarian intervention. Am I reading you correctly?
Yeah. Yeah. They were waiting. They were standing aside and waiting for their guy, Kagame, to seize power no matter the cost in human life. But ever since then, Bill Clinton has shed crocodile tears about this and said that this was the greatest mistake of his presidency.
And that's a justification for keeping Kagame in power and having a strong man in the region that cooperates with global corporations.
Absolutely.
And then there's a continuing propagandizing in the U.S. by having things like Rwanda Day here in San Francisco and keeping anybody who would question these issues from even attending as journalists.
Yes, absolutely.
Talk a little bit about the political prisoners.
I did want to emphasize that. This part of the world is so little reported on, it's difficult for people to contextualize it and make any sense of it. But some of the political prisoners, as individuals, their stories are, I think, easier to make sense of. The most prominent is Victoire Ingabire Umuhosa. She went to Rwanda in 2010 to run for president against Paul Kagame. She has instead been in prison since for genocide denial, encouraging Rwandans to rise up against the government. That means she tried to run for president. And terrorism, which is absolutely ridiculous. I've never known anyone more nonviolent than Victoire Ingabire Umuhosa. Another is Kizito Mihigo, a gospel singer. He recorded a song in which he said that Tutsis were not the only victims of the tragedy and that we had to mourn both. Okay, he's in prison for 10 years. Deo Mushaidi is a Tutsi. He was the president of the Rwandan Journalists Association. He responded to the injustice of the Hutu oppression by the Kagame regime, and he wrote the introduction to a book called Secrets of the Rwandan Genocide by Charles Onana. He's doing a life sentence. Dr. Leopold Munyakazi was just deported from the U.S. He is a kind, gentle scholar with multiple degrees in French, African languages, and African linguistics. And he gave several speeches on Eastern college and university campuses in which he said that the massacres were not properly understood as genocide because Rwandans are not really ethnically distinct, that this was a social class division between Hutus and Tutsis. It's not ethnic because they speak the same language, share the same culture. the vast majority are now Christian. They eat the same food. There's nothing that makes them ethnically distinct. For that, he was arrested. He struggled with it in the courts for a number of years with a pro bono lawyer who tried really hard to keep him here. He was just deported. And the horrible news now is that the government's prison authorities have given him some sort of chemicals that have scrambled his brain and made him incoherent. And they say, oh, he's traumatized by the deportation. But he was proud. He was proud to go back there and stand by his truth and hoping to be able to stand up in court and speak it.
Has there been any official or unofficial U.S. or State Department reaction or comments on the treatment of the political prisoners there? And secondly, has there been any critical media reporting at all on what's happening there in this regard?
The State Department has not reacted. I went through all the Clinton email to see whether they had mentioned Victoria Ingabire Mohosa in particular. No mention. They did mention Peter Erlander, a former National Lawyers Guild president who went to Rwanda to defend Victoria Ingabire Mohosa and was thrown in prison instead. There was a global mobilization to get him out of prison in Rwanda. There is a mobilization for Victoire Ingabire Mohosa, the most high-profile prisoner, and she has an appeal. This is very much worth understanding. She has an appeal to a regional court, might be better described as a supranational court, the African Court of Human and People's Rights. And when the court agreed to accept her appeal and opened the case, Kagame tried to withdraw from the court. He said, oh, this court entertains genocide deniers. And this is our one fundamental, ultimate truth. We're withdrawing from the court. The court said, no, the rules are that you have to give us a year's notice before you can withdraw from the court. So this case is going to be heard whether you answer it or not. And focusing international attention on this case in this little-known court, the African Court of Human and People's Rights, is one of the best things that anyone could do for Rwanda and for Congo, for the people of Rwanda and Congo now.
And thank you. You've been following this for a very long time, and I continue to hear you speak out and address this. You had a great article about Rwanda Day in the San Francisco Bay View on October 6th, which is available online, and you've been most helpful to us in keeping us aware of these issues as they are ongoing. So thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain.
You are tuned to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. Special thanks today to our producer Anthony Fest and our engineer Erica Bridgman. The Project Censored Show airs on 35 stations around the U.S. Archives can be found online at projectcensored.org. Please find us and like us on Facebook, and we will see you next time.
Ritualized alibis, disguise another guise of democracy, politics of the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burn bright with waves full of poison. Genocide wars fall for little poison. The weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons filled with capacity citizens. Hypnotized by the master thief. Combine, conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential fame. At the table, then you're probably on the menu.